On to item four, review of total portfolio performance for the period ending September 30th. Veris, Eileen, if you would hit the button, I'll turn your mic on.
Morning, Mr. Chair, and good morning, board members.
Good morning.
Hope you're all well this morning. I'm going to be speaking from the Veris Investment Performance Report. I will not, I promise, cover every page. In fact, we'll start on page seven. So it's always helpful to understand the economic drivers, both over the short term and the long term. So focusing on the most recent quarter, the third quarter of 2019, I call your attention to the table on the right-hand side of the page. And if you recall from last time we reviewed performance, I mentioned that essentially two main drivers of the capital market results we see are GDP and inflation, or rates. And so GDP, which is a measure of economic growth, was modest. It was 2.3, and this is as of the second quarter because the third quarter numbers are not finalized yet. But if you compare that to the year ago, it's lower. A year ago, it was a little bit more growth-oriented than right now, which we would call modest. Inflation remains at about the same level. And remember, the Fed is targeting 2%, so that's the kind of inflation we're seeing. However, we also show you expected inflation. This is based upon consensus, and actually, inflation is anticipated to decline somewhat, and this is really being driven by the reduction that we're seeing in energy prices. So over the next year or so, if energy prices continue to decline or fluctuate, that is likely to have an impact on that measure. The third statistic I want to point your attention to is that 10-year rate, and that was a really big factor, as we'll see in the results that we saw in the capital markets, particularly bonds. 1.7% as of the end of the third quarter, but if you look at a year ago, it's almost 50% lower, right? So what happened? We've had now three rate cuts, and there is concern about a slowdown in global growth, and that's what's really being reflected in that 10-year rate. Importantly, unemployment has improved, actually, modestly from over a year ago. So if we turn from there to, if we could jump up to slide 11, I wanted to make just a couple of comments about the consumer, having referenced the unemployment rate, because consumer spending, as you probably are all aware, drives the majority of our economic growth. About two-thirds of our economic growth is attributable to the consumer. And what we're seeing is, if you focus your attention on the graphs at the bottom of the page, sales growth is a measure of consumer health, and certainly it's risen back to the levels that it was prior to the global financial crisis, but it's stayed pretty steady state. In fact, you can see that it's actually dipped a little bit lower somewhat. So one little signal that probably factored into the Fed's decision to reduce rates. Auto sales is an example of a large ticket item that we've seen consumers. You can see that trend rate since the global financial crisis has been very strong until recently when it's moderated. So we think what's happening with consumers is we've had low inflation rates or low interest rates for so long that a lot of those capital purchases and items that are financed with debt, that consumers wanted to take advantage of low rates to purchase, they've purchased them. And so they're not going back out and buying, a new refrigerator or maybe a new car or another big ticket item at this point in time. And so that's why we're seeing this moderating activity. A good sign is the personal savings rate in the last graph in the lower right-hand side. You can see that that's been increasing. And for many years, there was concern that Americans were under-saving. And I think one of the lessons that it appears Americans have earned since the global financial crisis is to sock a little bit more away for a rainy day. So if we jump from there up to slide 14, we'll move from just focusing on the U.S. economy to putting the U.S. in the context of the rest of the world. So if you look at the graph on the right-hand side of the page and look at the GDP rate that we just saw for the U.S., it's 2.3%, and you can see it's pretty much higher, certainly relative to all of our fellow developed market countries. The only others with higher growth rates are those in the emerging markets, Russia and India, China, essentially. You could see our inflation rate is one of the lower rates relative to other countries. And interestingly, unemployment is also lower relative. In fact, if you look at that unemployment in the Eurozone, that's quite a high number. That's basically where we were at the depths of the global financial crisis. So things are not really in good shape over in Europe. And the good news, excuse me, for us, two things. One is we're really not dependent on foreign consumers. Our consumers really drive our economy as opposed to some other countries. So that is somewhat insulating. And at least in the Eurozone, we don't sell a lot of products there. We don't, but we tend to import more than we sell there. And our economic regime, if you will, our the Federal Reserve is much more independent here than the central banks over in Europe or in Asia, where they're very closely aligned with other countries. If we turn there and jump up to slide 18, if you would. And we compare here U.S. interest rates relative to, again, other countries focusing on interest rates. So you could see our 10-year rate, roughly 1.7%, and you actually see negative 10-year rates for a number of European countries and Japan. So the only other countries that are offering healthy interest rates are the main emerging markets, countries of China, Brazil, and Russia. So you can see that the U.S. capital markets are very attractive to foreigners, and part of the reason why we're having declines in our rates is because of the demand by foreigners for positive yielding assets. So with that as a backdrop, one more slide I'd like to cover in this section is slide 25, which focuses on the equity markets, specifically both U.S. and non-U.S. So you can see the return for the U.S. markets, if we look at large cap stocks, was about 1.7%. So that's in line with our long-term expectations. If we compounded that, if we experienced that same return for four quarters, that's basically at what our 10-year expectation for equities would be. You can see there was a big divergence in performance between large cap and small cap issues. It's because the engines of growth in our country tend to be those larger cap stocks. Also, small cap stocks underperformed most recently due to the fact that it is a lot of smaller companies that are actually being negatively impacted by the current trade war, as suppliers and distributors and so forth. So that's one of the drivers that we're seeing there. You can see in the international markets, it's an interesting dichotomy. On the left hand, we have the dollar-based returns for the international markets, but if we look at those markets in their own currencies, they're actually all positive returns as opposed to negative returns. So if you recall, a couple of meetings ago, we had an education on currency risk management. I think this is a very good example as to why we wanted to bring that to your attention and give you some information, because clearly you would have benefited in this quarter from having a hedged exposure, because the dollar was so much stronger relative to these other currencies. So that concludes my comments on the capital markets. Before I move on, are there any additional questions?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, Scott.
On page 25, under in the equity environment discussion, you had a, I guess it's the second bullet. It says, in the third quarter, the S&P 500 year-over-year earnings growth is expected to be minus 4.1%, which would put U.S. equities on track for three consecutive quarters of earnings lost. Did that actually wind up occurring?
It was negative, but it was, I don't believe, negative 4.1.
And what, if anything, is there to take away if you have three consecutive quarters of earnings loss? In other words, what's that mean to us?
Well, that is a sign that maybe things are slowing down economically, right? That the companies, for whatever reason, aren't selling as much of their products or are not achieving the earnings goals that they set or that they communicated when they gave their earnings projections.
But are there any other indicators that would suggest that the consecutive earnings loss has impacted those other areas significantly?
Well, the fact that we still had positive returns, I would say no. That is a sign that future returns could be impacted, though, if this continues, right? Because then the markets maybe will tend to become negative. Right now, we've got positive sentiment in the markets. Consumers are positive, and for the most part, companies are positive, maybe more mute. But as long as there's a positive view, people feel like they're going to get the returns they expect out of stocks in particular, that will continue to keep those valuations high. But if we continue to see earnings decline over some prolonged period, that will change, I'm assuming, pretty rapidly. And then you'll start seeing sell-offs, and then the negative returns will reflect the perception that companies are not doing well, and I'm not going to earn the return I expect to earn from that asset.
Thank you.
Any other questions on this section? Jerry?
A couple of months ago, everyone was on the recession is imminent bandwagon. And it was sort of like, if you hadn't predicted it, you better, because you might miss it. I don't even see it mentioned in here. So
yeah.
What happened to that? Are all these people now going to say things like, it's still coming, never, or never mind?
No, and it's very good that you bring that up and that you remembered that. It's very interesting. The recent articles that I've seen and what I've, you know, read and heard in the news is that people have backed off from the recession story, at least here in the U.S., not outside of the U.S., but here in the U.S., there is low probability, if you look across economists and money managers and so forth, recession is not in any of their projections, at least not in the near term. You mean never mind that we were worried about it and now, yeah. Yeah, I think that's a good way of summarizing it. And that's because, you know, what they feared at sort of the beginning of the year when we were hearing a lot of that, because after the last, remember, the fourth quarter of last year was very bad. What happened was things continued to progress. GDP growth continued to progress. Consumer sentiment remained high, even higher. Unemployment came down even more. So, and then the Fed cutting rates, you know, that gave people, I think, also a sense that, okay, as long as rates remain low, people will continue to, you know, borrow, extend credit, so forth.
Yes.
Doug, there's a chart in there I've never seen before called quit rate, which was, I'd never seen that before. I assume that's turnover rate, and I'm guessing that that will track almost exactly with unemployment. As unemployment goes down and stays down, the quit rate will go up.
Yes, that's very important.
Because people have got alternatives, choices. They can go someplace else, and they do. Yeah. I'm sorry, I forget what page it was.
I'm looking for that.
I just never seen the chart before. It's an interesting chart.
Quit rate, slide 12.
Yeah.
Sentiment. So that was actually the page after the one that we looked at regarding the consumer. So, yes, people are not holding on. Remember back in the depths of the recession, people were quitting. People were holding on, even if they were miserable in their jobs. But now we have two things. You know, we have a robust job market, and we're actually seeing some upward increase in wages.
Thanks.
John?
One of the things I hear prognostications on now three or four times is an S&P 500 at 3,500. Now it's about 3,100. Is that consistent with what we're seeing? And what kinds of projections are you looking at?
So we don't tend to project index levels because that is a technical variable. It's very hard to predict. What we tend to focus on are those main economic drivers of GDP, interest rates, what the Fed is doing. The Fed is very supportive and accommodative right now. That's positive. That's generally positive for stocks and actually positive for bonds, as we'll see over the last year. And as long as you have a climate where you have, doesn't have to be robust economic growth, as long as it's pure, steady economic growth and continued low unemployment, to us that means that we should expect positive returns from our assets and hopefully better than flat, somewhere in GDP growth plus some premium for dividends and maybe a modest amount. You don't even need a modest amount for capital appreciation to get a decent return, right? If you have GDP growth of, let's call it 2.5%, you've got dividend yields at roughly 2%, you're at 4.5% without any capital appreciation on stocks. It's lower than the historical average, but it's certainly a lot better than what you can get out of bonds and cash. And it's a fairly low, we're still in a fairly low risk or low volatility environment. And that also gives people some comfort, right? Because that means more price stability.
So don't take it to the bank, but maybe doable.
Yeah. Definitely can stay the course, right, in this environment.
Any other questions on Section 1? Not seeing any pop-up, so please continue.
Okay, so in Section 2, we'll start with page 2, and what we have here is a snapshot of how the portfolio grew over the quarter, and really you can see that the vast majority of the growth was actually due to positive cash flows as the investment returns translated to dollars were rather mute, maybe about a quarter fifth of the entire cash flow. So the portfolio did cross the $9 billion threshold at the end of the quarter. And then if we jump up to page 4, we see a snapshot of the current asset allocation relative to the policy, and you can see that they're very, very close in line, which we like to see and you should like to see, because that means that the closer you keep your actual portfolio to your policy portfolio, the higher the probability of meeting the expectations that you have for that policy portfolio. We turn to the next slide, slide 5. We're looking here at the total fund performance and then the performance of the main portfolio asset grouping. So we did see a modest positive return for the quarter of 0.5. So if you think back to that slide 4 where we looked at the dollar translation, you can see why that was a fairly low amount because we had a rather muted return. It was somewhat below policy for the quarter, although for the year to date, we have a very healthy return of 10.1%, which is slightly above the policy of 9.9%. So looking at the three main components, the largest being the growth portfolio, which is 68% of the total fund, we did have about a 0.2, so almost a flat return for that portfolio component, which was below policy of 1.1%. For the year to date, 12.1% is a very good return for the growth portfolio, modestly behind the policy of 12.5. So we'll all talk about that more in a moment. The diversifying portfolio outperformed the policy. It returned 1.8% and the policy 1.5. So you had a higher return from your diversifying portfolio than your equity portfolio, and this is one of the reasons why this portfolio segment was established, was to be able to provide returns that were differentiated and positive relative to your equity and bond portfolio. And that portfolio outperformed the year to date. And lastly, the liquidity portfolio, which is your sort of risk mitigation portfolio, also had a good return of 0.8%, modestly ahead of its policy index of 0.7 for the quarter, and a healthy return for the year to date of 4.2, which was also ahead of the policy 3.4. So the growth portfolio. There are basically four reasons for the underperformance that we saw for the quarter in the year-to-date relative to the policy. One of the biggest contributors is, and I'll show you and talk about this a little bit more in a moment, is what we would call benchmark misfit. So you have private asset portfolios. Private asset portfolios are difficult to benchmark. Right now, you're using what many of your peers use, are public security benchmarks plus a premium. The problem is that the private portfolios don't mark to market, at least not as frequently as those public market-based benchmarks do, which mark to market every single day. So that is part of the reason why we see the underperformance that we do. And in fact, it's a much higher contributor in some of the out years. The second reason is in the U.S. equity portfolio, we had some managers just underperform during the short-term period, and a couple of which have been very strong performing managers over the long term, but during this one quarter, they underperformed. Another factor that contributed to some modest underperformance is that the portfolio is overweight to non-U.S. equities relative to U.S. equities, and some of the negative performance of active managers in that portfolio then contributed to the underperformance. And then within that portfolio component, we do have a modest overweight to emerging markets. And emerging markets performed worse than developed markets did. So those were sort of the four, the top two, the U.S. equity manager performance and the benchmark misfit being the greatest. And so if we jump up to slide 7 and look at the growth portfolio, looking at the domestic equity portfolio, you can see that it's really Jackson Square Partners that had the largest impact on the domestic equity portfolio return. The other managers actually added value relative to their benchmarks for the quarter. So again, a short-term phenomena. Obviously, your staff and Verus are continuously monitoring these managers. I don't think we have any long-term concerns. Just even managers that are highly skillful, just statistically speaking, tend to underperform 20% of the time. If you look on slide 8, we see the performance of the international equity portfolio. And you can see, looking down at the emerging market line, the performance of emerging markets. And if you compare that, just looking at the benchmark, negative 4.2 for the quarter, relative to the developed market or international equity, which is the MSCI ACWI XUSA Gross, that's a negative 1.7. So just that differential there, having more in that emerging market component relative to the benchmark was one of those contributors that I mentioned earlier.
Jerry?
I don't know if you want to comment or if Tim might have a comment on Emerald. Gives new meaning to the word volatility on Emerald's performance. It's like that old line about the weather in Chicago. If you don't like it, wait a couple of minutes.
Yep.
And Emerald has just got this up and down thing that will give you the bends. And is that because of just the bets that they tend to make, or and sometimes they're there and sometimes they're not?
Yeah, I think Emerald certainly small cap growth with an emphasis on biotech and some other niche industries. They're targeting industries that, by their very nature, are more thinly traded, so they tend to be more volatile. They tend to have more binary outcomes. I think if we look over the long term, we have been rewarded. But this has been something we revisited every couple of years, is the volatility profile here. I will say the one comforting factor over the quarter is, you know, in terms of the process of rebalancing for Cicera, we did take $70 million out of this portfolio at the end of July. Portfolio was up at the end of July. August was down 7%, so we got out ahead of that. So I think in terms of the profit-taking associated with some of these more volatile portfolios, has been working, but yeah, it is a volatile profile. I think that's part of the reason over the past year and a half, it's had a tremendous run-up. We felt it was prudent to take a third of the portfolio off the table, is what we did. Yeah,
makes sense. Thank you.
Can you comment on the two emerging markets managers, because they both were worse than their benchmarks, and obviously TT was much better for the year, but can you comment on that?
Sure. So the PIMCO RAE Emerging Market Strategy is actually a value strategy, and they're being compared to an emerging markets benchmark. It's something that Tim and I discussed when we are going through the asset liability study next year. We do intend to make just review of all benchmarks a part of that study, and that one should be revisited. When we compared them relative to that benchmark, the MSCI value, they actually outperformed relative to that benchmark, I believe. And then TT, they have a growth orientation. There was a couple of months during this last quarter where we saw momentum is a risk factor that we use to define growth, if you will. Momentum really sold off in favor of value or valuation just for a couple of months, and not real sure why. And so a lot of portfolios with that growth orientation were hit during that quarter.
And just one more comment on the PIMCO emerging market strategy. Quarter to date in the fourth quarter, and we never like to focus on the short term, but we need to talk about some inflection points here. Fourth quarter to date, they're up 4.5%. So again, a volatile portfolio, but you know, at the 9:30 mark, down significantly. Thus far in the fourth quarter, up significantly.
Yeah, and that's a very good point. Why I made the comment earlier. You know, we looked across your managers, and you know, there's really no red flags in this component of the portfolio. It's just, again, sometimes good managers underperform, and unfortunately all underperform at once. But that wasn't a huge factor throughout your portfolio. It was really more in that U.S. equity component. I wanted to jump up to slide 9 to illustrate the point I made earlier about the benchmark misfit, and actually we'll probably flip between slide 9 and slide 7, but on slide 9, I'll focus your attention on the private credit and the private equity portfolio. So the private credit had actually a great return for the quarter relative to the benchmark. But if you look at the year-to-date, you could see there was really strong underperformance for the year-to-date period. And remember, this is a private income-oriented portfolio. You're not going to see a lot of volatility. There's not trading going on in there. There's nothing that would have changed in terms of the objective and thesis of that portfolio. But because it's being measured against the high yield, the public markets index, where there is a lot of volatility and is affected by technical trading, that will cause large variations between those two. So there are private credit indices that have been introduced over the last couple of years, and some of them have had backfilled histories, and those are benchmarks that we're looking at for other clients with private credit portfolios, and that will again be part of our review at the asset allocation study. So I bring your attention down to the private equity. Now, the private equity is a much bigger part of your portfolio. It's 11% of your portfolio, and you can see for the 3 months, and in fact, if you look at the 1 year, 3 year, 5 year, 10 year, all behind the benchmark by a significant amount. And because of that 10% weighting, that has a large impact on that relative performance you see on slide 7. In fact, for the 1 year number, it was roughly 50% of that underperformance for the 1 year came from that private equity benchmark misfit. So there's nothing wrong or structurally wrong with the portfolio. It's just simply a demonstration of the fact that benchmarks are important. And in this area where it's very difficult to benchmark, we just have to be thoughtful. And we do have some alternatives, is the good news. And we will be bringing that back to you early next year.
Looking at the 1, 3, 5, 10-year comparisons, looking at the 1, 3, 5, 10-year comparisons, it looks like it's not a good benchmark, or we have had a terrible period. My reaction is the benchmark is probably not a very good fit.
Yes, and that would be a correct one. I remember this has been a bull market during this period for public equities. Public equities have been going up and up and up. Private equity portfolios can't write up securities. They certainly can't write them up until pretty much the end of the investment period. So they're not writing up to the same degree that the public equity portfolios are able to. And that's really the differential. In fact, we were going to review your, just briefly, because I know StepStone is going to be here. If you turn up to slide 17.
Actually, before you get there.
Sure.
So I'm a little concerned that we have the benchmark discussion when we miss the mark, but I guess when times are good, we don't pay as much attention to the benchmark as being inappropriate. Does that strike you as odd?
I think we're paying attention to it here because we wanted to introduce the concept of, you know, that we were going to address this benchmark misfit. I think historically, plan sponsors and consultants have, you know, picked a benchmark that is not perfect, but it's kind of considered an industry standard, right? So U.S. equities plus a premium.
Right.
And basically, it is what it is. But there are benchmark alternatives that have gotten better for private markets in the last few years. And so really the primary reason for bringing it up is that we want to be able to address it. Otherwise, if we had no other alternative, we'd be telling you, you know, this is not what you should be focusing on the short term. We should be focusing on internal rate of return, rates of return, and relative to a much longer term benchmark, and that's more relevant than these short term comparisons. That is still the case, but even these short term comparisons can be improved by better benchmarks, by implementing better benchmarks.
Yeah, I would just, Trustee Gordon, I think the last time we did the capital market assumption for the asset allocation study, we certainly highlighted that a public market plus a premium is a non-investable benchmark. There is no way to directly invest in that benchmark. Therefore, we know it was the least bad option to fell onto at the time, with the expectation that we were going to continue to revisit this. I would also highlight that the private credit benchmark, even though we're beating that one significantly over a long period of time, again, is not the right benchmark. These tend to be more income-oriented strategies. We're looking for steady returns. I tend to focus on the year-by-year. Are we seeing the pattern? If we're not getting the mark-to-market volatility, are we seeing the pattern we expect? And we do see that. If you look at the 2018, 17, you know, year-by-year, we're getting the positive returns off that, as well as off the private equity benchmark or private equity program, where we're getting low double-digit returns, which is in line with our long-term expectation. The benchmarking sometimes is a public market proxy. We need to understand, I think, from an efficacy standpoint, did we make the right decision to deploy money into these spaces? We locked up the capital. We could have stayed in the public markets. Was that a prudent decision? So there needs to be some kind of tie back to the public markets. But really, we're targeting more of an absolute level of return in these spaces, or something closer to that absolute level of return. It's a fine line. You bring up a good point. We're not trying to make excuses. We're trying to provide context. But understand that anything that you see a public market plus a premium, it's the least bad option, and we should be looking for something better.
Yeah, I mean, at least it's consistent. It's not as if we changed the benchmark every other year because we didn't think it was suitable or tried to noodle with it. So, I mean, my point is, if you have the same benchmark for 10 years, and at least you're measuring the performance by the same stick, right? I would just be a little concerned if we're going to do a benchmark study, because your colleague, not recalling his name, a couple years ago I was at a conference, he underscored the importance of this very subject. His entire hour lecture was on benchmarks, the importance of them, what they mean, and why we people like us should care. And I took note of it. And so this discussion seems apropos about the suitability of benchmarks here. I mean, I look back at the prior slide or two. TT, when you've got a trailing year to date, and current quarter all negative, I would think that would cause some alarms. You can look at these private equity numbers, perhaps differently, and say it's more about the benchmark not being a good fit, but it's still something you have to take note of. It seems to me it's just not escapable.
No, we're certainly not looking to change benchmarks to explain away poor performance. We're looking at, does the benchmark explain the behaviors we're seeing? And if it doesn't, it's incumbent upon us to look for a better fit there. I would say, even if we could maintain a public market benchmark plus a premium, the 400 basis points is not reflective of the opportunity set any longer. That was a benchmark that's been in place since 1996 for us. The private equity universe has changed materially over the past 23 years. The premiums have come down. The marketplace is just more efficient. So even if we maintain a public market plus a premium, you're going to see those numbers start to ratchet down.
Okay. Thanks.
Before I move on to the private equity, on slide 10, we have the remaining two portfolio components, diversifying and liquidity. And both of those portfolios outperformed relative to their respective policies for the 3 months and year to date. The diversifying portfolio longer term, I think Tim a couple of meetings ago and last meeting indicated that we're looking at alternative strategies. I know myself and my colleague, Mike Mel, reached out to our manager research group, and we've gotten a couple of ideas from them that we'll be communicating to Tim. So continuing, this is a work in progress as we move this portfolio closer to the objective for the portfolio. And then if we jump up to slide 17, we do have the internal rates of returns for the private markets components of the portfolio. So with the private credit, I would say, we're seeing pretty good IRRs with one exception, and I'm sure this will be talked about in more detail, so I don't want to belabor that. But if you look across the that column, CCC, ERA, net, that's really should be your focus, and pretty good. For the most part, double-digit returns. Some of the investments are newer, so they're not now the point yet where we can say that those results indicative of what you're going to ultimately experience at the end, but some of those that are closer to the end of their investment lives have, I would say for the most part, achieved very good results. And with that, I just want to call your attention to one more slide, which is slide 27. And, I know plan sponsors like to look at peer comparisons, and in my view, if you're going to compare yourself relative to peers, you have to all be put on the same playing field, and the way to do that is to use a ratio. In this case, we're using the Sharpe ratio, which is a measure of risk-adjusted returns. And so when you look at how your portfolio compares relative to peers, you rank very well, above median and in the top quartile relative to your peers in terms of the Sharpe ratio. So what that means is you've done a pretty good job, maybe slightly better job than a lot of your peers, of getting the types of returns you expect for the level of risk that you're taking. So you're getting paid for the risk that you're taking in a way that translates to a healthy risk-return ratio. So that concludes my formal comments. I'd be happy to answer any additional questions.
Scott? Did you run the total fund Sharpe ratio ranking net of fees as well?
I think we can run it. We didn't run it. But if you prefer to see that, I think that is some an analytic that we can add. Not all your peers report net of fees, but everyone reports gross of fees. That's why we use this, because okay. It's going to be a more robust universe.
I think the last time we looked at that, the difference between the gross of fee universe and the net of fee universe was almost cut in half.
Yeah.
So it just wasn't as robust of a universe. But certainly net of fees is the way to look at it. To the extent we can get the data.
Yeah, if it's not going to be meaningful, though, because half the others aren't doing it, then it doesn't.
Yeah,
I get it. Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? I'm not seeing any. Thank you very much.
Thank you all very much.
Ian,
yes. He's the author of the environment slides, so I think the quits must be a Scottish term.
Okay. On to item 4B, presentation from staff. Tim.
So we'll run through this fairly quickly. This is the complementary report to the consultant's quarterly report, where the consultant's quarterly report is very detailed down to the asset class level and value versus growth and down to every single line item. This report really is our attempt to take a step back and say, if we had just implemented the asset allocation as determined by the board into three buckets, each one with a simple investable benchmark, how would we have done? And then also take a look at our unique measures of success around each sub-portfolio and how have we done there. When I look at this report, I'm looking for two things. One, if each one of the sub-portfolios met their individual objectives, it's going to roll up to a total fund outcome that's positive. And two, if we're going to accept complexity in the portfolio, much along the lines of what we just discussed in terms of the private equity and private credit, if we're going to accept that complexity, did we get compensated for it relative to a simple implementation, which in this case is just buying a representative index? So I'm going to turn your attention to slide 3, which is our top-level report card. We have individual objectives for each one of the three sub-portfolios and then for the total fund. If you're seeing green, we're meeting expectations. If you're not seeing green, we have a conversation to be had. Liquidity has the fewest moving pieces. This is short duration, cash matched to our expected liabilities. What we're looking for there is credit quality remaining high. That's achieved. We had a AA-, quite high there. Duration has to remain low. We're at 1.8 years, which is right in line with expectations. And it has to be appropriately sized. We have a board target of 48 months of benefit payments in reserve that we draw down over the course of the year. What you're looking at here is right after the refresh in July, so we have 46 months of benefit payments, right on track there. We really should not expect to see any material deviation from those numbers in this portfolio. Within the growth portfolio, this is measured against the MSCI ACWI Global Equity Benchmark. If we're going to capture global GDP growth, that's a broad representative index. So we're looking for absolute level of return. Over the past 5 years, the growth portfolio has returned 7.6%. So low, or sorry, high single digit return is roughly in keeping with what we expect. That number probably is going to be slightly lower in the future. We'll talk about that next year when we bring capital market assumptions back to you. We also want to be beating the benchmark. In this case, we're a percent above the MSCI ACWI, so we are being rewarded for the complexity in terms of total rate of return. We're a percent above the broad global equity benchmark on a net of fee basis, and we want to be efficient. Eileen touched on the Sharpe ratio. I think that is the absolute pertinent measure for the growth portfolio. Per unit of risk accepted, we're getting about double the MSCI ACWI. We return have a Sharpe ratio of 1. The index is a Sharpe ratio of 0.5. So everything there is lining up with our long-term expectations. Risk diversifying, we're looking for an offset to the growth portfolio. We saw that in the third quarter when the growth portfolio really kind of bounced around a lot, but without a lot of direction. The risk diversifying gave us a positive rate of return. We see a correlation of about 0.5 over the trailing 5 years. We want that number to be, that's kind of pushing the upper bound of what we want to see. We'd like that number to come down a bit further to 0.4 or less. Positive real returns. This is something we touched on at the last meeting where we said, you know, this is clearly an area where we're not meeting expectations. You're seeing a trailing 5-year real return number, so nominal return minus inflation of negative 0.8. That number was negative 1.2% last quarter, so we're seeing an improving trend. I think this is, we saw a very difficult year for Wellington in 2015, followed by, you know, some recovery, difficult year last year, recovery, but it really is around that. So we're have a concerted effort to reduce the allocation of that portfolio relatively quickly. You're going to be seeing a due diligence notice coming out to the trustees very soon about a new strategy that we have under consideration in that space, and that would be a direct drawdown against the Wellington portfolio there. And the other thing is it's got to have a high degree of liquidity. This is intended to be an anchor to Windward and to be opportunistic to be redeployed into the public equity market. So we need to be able to sell this or sell a portion of this portfolio to buy dislocated equity securities. If the S&P 500 is down 20%, we want to be buyers of that. We're going to be using some of this capital, so we need to be able to sell. So we test liquidity in our model in a period of equity market stress. It's difficult to do that, but we do believe we can liquidate 100% of the portfolio within 90 days and the vast majority within 30 days. So with that, most of the portfolios meeting the expectations, we roll it up to the total fund. We have the 4 years of benefit payments in reserve. Check that box. We are participating efficiently in the growth opportunities that are available to us on a Sharpe ratio basis. We can check that box. The risk diversifying is providing an offset to the growth volatility. We can check that box. And we have superior risk-adjusted returns on the total fund base, total fund Sharpe ratio. Eileen touched on that. It's also in the back of this report. Check that box. The remainder of the report does a deeper dive into each one of the sub-portfolios and the managers highlighted therein. I'm going to move through this relatively quickly unless there's trustee questions.
There's Jerry. A question about a firm or manager like Wellington. When you approach, and Wellington sees the numbers before we do, are they inclined to respond that we're being faithful to our goals and objectives and our approach? And if that doesn't work for you, we're sorry about that. Or are they inclined to think they should change something? Or how faithful are they to what they're doing?
This is an allocation that has a 50% mandated target to inflation hedging strategies. So when we look at this, I would say the inflation hedging strategies have been the challenging portion. We have talked to them about changing the guidelines. They are reluctant to change the guidelines for everybody in a collective pool. Okay. I completely understand. But that, you know, any type of strategy that looks to offset inflation is down. So commodity strategies are down. TIPS, we have falling forward inflation expectations are down. So it's really been a challenging portion for them. I think there's a rationale for what they're doing. We hired Wellington back when we had an explicit inflation hedging allocation, which has been unwound. This has been reallocated in the space. We know it's a partial fit that we'd like to improve, will improve. We've had robust conversations with them. They've showed us, you know, could we just slide into the portion that's not inflation hedging, that sort of thing. I'd say we have very honest and open discussions. You recall that about 3 years ago, the portfolio experienced a significant decline in the commodities exposure. That portfolio manager left. A new portfolio manager came in, controlled the risk significantly, and it's been more of a even ride since then. But you've got that big dislocation in 2015, so I think there's a rationale for it. It's just not exactly what we're looking for on a prospective basis.
I don't want you to have to speak for Wellington, but I guess I'm asking you to do that. When you suggest, they say the other people in the strategy are happy, they're reluctant, I guess that leads to my question, they're reluctant to change the strategy for the entire group. Does that suggest that the rest of the group is happy with the performance?
Or the rest of the group has an explicit inflation hedging goal in mind. I mean, inflation hedging right now hasn't worked, but it's very cheap. And there are investors who say, understanding that commodities haven't worked, understanding that energy's down, understanding that forward inflation expectations down, this is the time I want to move in and buy these hedges because they don't cost me a lot. On the off chance that I do see inflation expectations pick up in the future. So I'd say from a staying true to the stated mandate, they have. Has our mandate migrated? Absolutely. And that's where it's coming upon us to find a better fit there.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Just one second.
Sorry, 30 Jay. Seconds. You kind of, in two lines there, gave a fairly good argument for holding some kind of inflation hedging exposure. Redeeming from Wellington here, doesn't seem to leave a lot of explicit kind of inflation surprise left in the portfolio.
Yeah.
Is it? Are you counting on kind of the short duration nature of the liquidity portfolio and in the long run, maybe the growth portfolio, the equities to catch up there to kind of provide that at a plan level? Or
I think that's a fair representation that there was a point in time where the concerns around inflation were significant. Post-global financial crisis, watching the supply of money flow into the system, I think it was a fairly natural response for a lot of systems to say, we're concerned that inflation could show up here in a way that would be harmful to us. And with a different asset allocation, they wanted an explicit hedge. I think there's a completely rational response around that. I think with the approach we have with liquidity, you know, just kind of maintaining there, with growth capturing inflation over a long enough time period, it hasn't been as much of a focus in terms of capital market assumptions, in terms of asset liability modeling. Now, we will have an asset liability study coming back to the trustees first half of next year, so we'll revisit, you know, the role of inflation, how much explicit hedging do we want. But I think in terms of the way we have it structured right now, we haven't seen the inflation. The role of the central bank over the past decade is just different from what we've seen over the prior 20 to 30 years. And I think the damaging effect of inflation that we're concerned about hasn't been manifested, and it's kind of less of a priority. I'll move quickly through the sub-portfolios here. The liquidity sub-portfolio, again, not a lot of degrees of freedom. It's performing as expected. Insight, SIT, and DFA kind of nest together there. Everybody with a modestly positive yield in the 2.2 to 2.5% range, duration in the 1.2 to 2.7-year range, and one-year total returns in the 5 to 6.6%. Do not expect short-duration fixed income to give you 6.6% in a normal interest rate environment. This is a, you know, enjoy it while you get it scenario. The growth sub-portfolio on slide 5, just want to highlight a few things here. I think what we're seeing is some slowing in terms of certainly active equity managers are continuing to see outflows from their strategies. If you look at the one-year firm growth, you'll see a number of negative numbers there, these with the exception of BlackRock, which is primarily passive-oriented. So money does continue to flow out of active equity strategies writ large. Where we see inflows, it is in the passive side. Emerging markets, despite the volatile ride, has had a large inflow. That's largely based upon, from my conversations with other investors, the valuations are so low that the asset class is incredibly attractive on a forward-looking basis today. The other thing I want to draw your attention to, on the bottom, if you look at the trailing 5 years, regardless of the asset segment, we're looking at some pretty strong returns. It's been a good growth environment writ large. The one-year numbers, we're seeing a lot of negative. I think Eileen touched upon a number of factors looking at the market that, you know, you're looking at the slowing, you're looking at declining earnings, a flattening forward expectations. Yep, the, you know, the U.S. worker is benefiting. You're starting to see those quit rates come up, but I think on the forward-looking expectations for global growth, it's just kind of flattening out. To Jerry's point about, you know, the recession conversation kind of truncating, I think a lot of what we saw is a flattening. People looked at that and said, is that going to become declining? It really hasn't. It's just kind of flattening right now.
Tim?
Yes.
Quick question. On the trailing 1 year, what struck me was the spread, right, between Emerald and Adelante. And would you expect to see that kind of a spread? I mean, I get the rest of the numbers are fairly tightly grouped, right?
Yeah.
You know, 1, 4, 3, 2, whatever in terms of, you know, the small trailing year lag. But I was struck by the, you know, if I take Panagora, Adelante, and then I look at an Emerald, that's a big spread.
Yeah, it is. I think with Emerald, we addressed the volatility profile. I think that is somewhat idiosyncratic to Emerald. Certainly small cap underperformed large cap, and I think touched upon the impact of disruption to supply chains from the trade war. Smaller companies don't have the resiliency of larger companies to redeploy as easily. They're getting smacked a little bit more there. Adelante is in the REIT space. REITs were hammered in the fourth quarter of 2018. You're seeing a rebound effect here. I think what you're also seeing is REITs are required to pay out a dividend yield, required to pay out 90 or 95% of their operating income. The desire for yield and the bidding up of those assets is very real, and REITs have had a good year as a result. AQR and Panagora, these are our risk parity managers. You know, sometimes it's better to be lucky than good. And risk parity is something we studied for a long period of time. It had a good track record. It had a very, very difficult 2018. These strategies were down 6 to 10% in 2018. We funded AQR, I think on December 31st, or maybe January 2nd or something like that. We're up 17% year to date with AQR. Panagora, this is a composite number. We haven't been in there. I think we funded in February. Again, it's up strongly double digits. I think the risk parity thesis, as much as it suffered last year for reasons that were a little bit murky, has strongly benefited from the snapback this year. And we just happened to get in at the trough.
Well, the comment on small cap growth was interesting. We keep a lot of there's been a lot of discussion about tariffs and what their effects are, and they keep seems like they get delayed, or there's some new understanding about whether they will or won't apply to this or that. It's hard to tangibly see what they actually affect, you know, in terms of everyday living. And that's the first time I've actually heard a dot connected between a fund's performance and that disruptive element in that.
I would say, you know, the space, the small cap growth space, small cap space in general has been more impacted. The additional underperformance from Emerald over the past year is more idiosyncratic to the companies being held by Emerald. So I think you have two things working against you in the short term.
Okay. That's helpful. Thank you.
Last sub-portfolio, risk diversifying. Again, we just reviewed this at the last meeting, so not a lot of new updates there. AFL-CIO having a strong one-year return. Again, on the fixed income story of the declining rates, this has got about a five-year duration fixed income portfolio. It's up 10% over the past year, up 3% over the past 5 years. Parametric, still relatively new. This is our insurance selling strategy. With the changing volatility of the S&P 500, this one's had a difficult start. I will say it's thus far in the fourth quarter, in the latter part of the third quarter, we're seeing the pattern we expect of, you know, about 70 basis points of incremental return per month. So starting to get its feet underneath it, and Wellington we've discussed at length there. So when we roll everything up into the total fund, what do I look for? Well, slide 9, I'm looking for the spread between upside capture and downside capture. Based upon the asset allocation we have and the risk profile we've accepted, we're a little bit lower risk than most of our peers. So relative to an index, we're expected to capture most of the upside, but less of the downside. And so you can see over time, we've been capturing between about 80 and 95% of when the market, or when our index is up, our custom index is up, and about anywhere from 65% down to 35% of the downside. When we launched this report a couple of years ago and we were looking at those numbers in the 45, I caution trustees, don't count on only capturing half of the downside. That's unrealistically strong. But if we're maintaining the spread is what I'm looking for more than the absolute return. We are maintaining the spread there.
Tim, can you go back for a minute and talk? I know we've talked a lot about Wellington before with the board, but can you talk a little bit more about the one-year product asset growth number and remind the board what's going on with them and kind of our plan around Wellington?
Yep. So, again, to the discussion with Jerry around different investors in the strategy have different goals. I would say that they had a large fund pull out of the strategy based upon no longer having an inflation hedging goal. So the negative 64% year-over-year loss in assets there is a result of primarily one large fund investor pulling assets out. There's also not, this is not a large strategy, so one investor pulling out is a significant chunk there. We're looking at the, I believe, $170 million we have in Wellington as the funding source for our pipeline of risk diversifying strategies going forward. The first one of those will be going to due diligence probably within a day or two, and the trustees will see a notice on that. We intend to draw down against Wellington to fund those new strategies. So over December and through the first quarter, the first two strategies that we're looking at there are going through due diligence. If we're successful, we'll be drawing down that capital to redeploy. I would expect this to be redeployed in the first half of 2020. Final comment from me, because I know you've probably heard enough, will be on slide 10. The knowing laughs are telling me when to know. The top panel there really just talks about the one quarter attribution analysis. We outperformed the simple target index, but I want to turn your attention to the middle table there. Relative to that simple target index, again, if we were going to pick three representative indices to represent our allocation and just invest in those, what we get relative to what we have actually done, and this is where you see over the 1 year, 3 year, 5 year, 10 year period, we have produced excess returns relative to the simple target index. So it's been accretive from a top-line perspective, and we've taken less risk. And I think taking less risk and achieving excess returns is what we really are laser-focused on when we're doing our management research, when we're doing our asset liability study, and the efficacy is really laid out in this table here. So you get to the Sharpe ratio at that point, you're producing a superior Sharpe ratio over all trailing historical time periods here of a significant premium over that simple index. With that, any questions for trustees?
Any questions? I'm not seeing any. Thank you. Yes.